You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
This is Tea Break Archaeology, where we explore the ancient origins of everyday objects. Hello, and welcome to episode 37 of Tea Break Archaeology. My name is Dr. Mathilde Siebrecht, and today I'm savouring a black caramel tea, which is absolutely delicious, and we finally have full-fat milk back in the fridge as well, so it's actually a really nice and creamy cup of tea, which I know some of you are probably listening to me and going, what, full-fat milk in tea? The horror. But I must say I quite like it. I quite like a nice creamy cup of tea every so often. Anyway, and welcome to this little tea break with just me, no guest today. But in the tea break today, we are going to do a little dive into the origins and the archaeology of the notebook. Now, I don't know about you, I love a good notebook. I have a whole shelf just full of notebooks. And it's the classic, right? That you have notebooks that you use all the time, but then you also have some which are just so beautiful and so well made, and you just can't use them. Because in order to use them, you have to have like an epic purpose for them somehow. I have now started using my nice notebooks for just normal things because otherwise I'm not going to use them. But anyway, and yes, I very much enjoy notebooks. My favorite kind of notebook, I think, are the sort of the ones that look like they've come out of an ancient library, you know, like good old leather bound, beautiful, thin, old fashioned paper and nice bindings and everything. Although I must say I do prefer lined notebooks as well. I'm not so good at writing in blank notebooks. I get overwhelmed by everything where everything is. It's a lot easier, I find, if the notebooks are lined. And then actually, I must say I'm quite particular. I don't know if people listening are familiar with, for example, moleskin notebooks or Leuchtturm notebooks. Those ones have the perfect spacing of lines and thickness of lines. Because I also don't like it if the lines are too dark or too far apart, spaced too far apart. Anyway, there we go. We're 2 minutes in and I'm already just ranting to you about my favorite notebooks. This has gone off to a flying start. But yes, the whole point of this is to look a little bit into the origins of notebooks and look into when notebooks first came about, how they have developed into what they have today, to the point where I can decide whether I want to have ones with thick, widely spaced lines or thin lines. And we have so much variation today, but where do they actually come from and how did they get into our society? So the first thing I guess to cover is the idea of writing, because although, of course, you can draw in notebooks and people do nowadays, one of the first things that notebook is primarily used for in the majority of times is to jot down notes, to take down notes, which we'll get to a little bit in a second. But so in order to look at notebooks, you then already have to look a little bit about the origins of writing and why people started using notebooks in that respect. And I mean, we'll get to what actually is a notebook or how we would define a notebook soon, but I do want to just briefly cover the origins of writing. So those of you who listen to this podcast already will know that I am a prehistorian. So that means that I mainly deal with times that came before the invention of writing. So all of those time periods and cultural periods that happened and they didn't have written sources. So they didn't write things. It depends a little bit how you define writing in this case, of course, because you have, for example, different standing stones with different carved symbols on. Did they count as writing or not? You have different forms of cave art and cave painting. Did they count as writing or are they art? How does one define writing in the first place? But in general, it's sort of agreed that once historic sources appear, once historic written sources appear, that's when history then starts. And anything before writing is prehistory. So that's the part that I'm sort of most interested in. And it's quite an interesting way of actually studying archaeology as well. There's quite different approaches depending on whether you're more focused on prehistory or history. So for example, as I mentioned in the last episode, being a prehistorian, my main focus is on the material culture or the sort of material evidence. So in my case, it's the material culture, the artifacts, but of course people can look at the skeletons, look at the buildings, look at the environments. But the point being, prehistoric people can't tell us about themselves. And in some cases, you'll have parts of prehistory where there's sort of a little bit of an overlap or a sort of blurred line between what actually, when history started, you know? So you'll have historic cultures who already have writing talking about something that we might define as prehistoric cultures, but cultures that do not have writing. And that's always quite dangerous, right? Because just imagine you're writing about something that's very biased by your opinion, your interpretation, how you see the world, how you have experienced the thing that you are writing about. And therefore, that won't necessarily be the same experience as someone else. So this is something that historians have to take into account a lot, of course, like that you have these historic sources who give these beautiful accounts and beautiful histories of these great events or of these cultures or of these places, but you always have to take it with a little bit of a pinch of salt. The nice thing with prehistory is, of course, you have different kinds of biases. You have what we call interpretational bias, which is basically when you as the archaeological researcher are biased in how you interpret something because you will only interpret it based on your own experience, right? So if you don't know what a leather needle looks like, then you won't be able to recognize those leather needles in the archaeological record. The reason that I came up with that is because there's a leather needle sitting next to me on the desk here. But so there is already sort of interpretive bias when you're looking at prehistory, but at least it's only sort of at a researcher level. It's not another level, whereas in history you have kind of another level. And I personally always found it so difficult to pick through all of that and make sure that you were having as unbiased an interpretation of something as possible. So you have kind of differences in how you study history or how you study prehistory. So that means that actually the start of writing was really important in terms of the development of humanity, but also in how we study that development and how we study humanity as well. But so let's think a little bit about that, about the start of writing. What does that actually mean? What does that actually entail? And I really like, actually, when I was sort of researching for this episode and for the blog post that I've written to go alongside it, which you can find on my website, the link is in the show notes, I found this really interesting quote from one of Plato's Phaedrus 14. And Plato, I imagine most people are familiar with Plato, but he was, of course, an ancient Greek philosopher. And a lot of his writings involve dialogues between him and his teacher, Socrates. How real these dialogues are is, you know, something that I guess we'll never really know. But it's sort of different ways of exploring philosophical concepts by basically having this conversation and writing it down. So this particular Phaedrus comes from about 380 BCE, BCE meaning before Common Era, so before the year zero. And it's about the invention of writing. And it's basically the inventor of writing, who's, you know, completely fictional. There's not one person who invented writing, who's called Thoth. I'm not sure how you pronounce it. He comes to the king of Egypt at the time, Thamuz, and he says, "This invention, O king, this writing I've invented, this invention, O king, will make the Egyptians wiser and will improve their memories, for it is an elixir of memory and wisdom that I have discovered." And then the king says back to him, basically, "Let me be the judge of that." And he says, "Most ingenious Thoth, one man has the ability to beget arts, but the ability to judge of their usefulness or harmfulness to their users belongs to another. And now you, who are the father of letters, have been led by your affection to ascribe to them a power the opposite of that which they really possess. For this invention will produce forgetfulness in the minds of those who learn to use it, because they will not practice their memory. Their trust in writing, produced by external characters which are no part of themselves, will discourage the use of their own memory within them. You have invented an elixir not of memory, but of reminding, and you offer your pupils the appearance of wisdom, not true wisdom, for they will read many things without instruction and will therefore seem to know many things, when they are, for the most part, ignorant and hard to get along with, since they are not wise, but only appear wise." Which, I mean, you know, in short form is basically someone saying, "Yo, I've invented writing, it's going to help us with our memory and it's going to make us more wise." And then the king's going, "No, it won't, because before I used to have to remember everything, but now I don't have to remember everything. I just have to copy it down and then it seems as if I'm wise, but I'm just reading from pre-prepared notes." Which is kind of ironic, considering that's basically what I'm doing now, is writing from notes that I have written down to pre-prepare. So, I mean, I think that Thamuz has a point. And I also find it really fascinating that this conversation isn't unique within our human history, right? I mean, even nowadays, when we're talking about AI and sort of the use of different technologies and different tools to assist us as humans. And there's a lot of discussion about, like, okay, but then is that actually beneficial to humans in the long run? I mean, there's all these talks, right, of AI causing us to become basically mindless sheep because we don't actually think for ourselves anymore. We just let a machine think for us. And I find it really fascinating that these sorts of discussions were already happening back in 380 BCE, you know, were already happening 2000 years ago. So, you know, it's a conversation that is definitely timeless, but also something about writing specifically that is really interesting is that it marks the start of things being quite literally set in stone. So up till that point, information had been passed on through word of mouth. Information had been retained by people. History itself, traditions, those kinds of things were all constantly developing, constantly evolving, because they were flexible. They depended on the people who spoke about them. They were able to adapt to different times, to different environments, to different societies and different needs. Whereas at the point where things start to get written down, then suddenly it's not as flexible anymore. It's not as adaptable anymore. And I know you can argue that, of course, histories are also adaptable and people change them over time as well. But the point I'm making is that this really marked a big point in our social development, because suddenly information was being kind of made permanent in a way. And what's really fascinating is that the people who were writing down that information were of a particular hierarchy, of a particular class, of a particular educational level, that meant that they were not, for example, your average toiler in the streets and these kinds of things, because they had the time to be able to dedicate time, energy, and resources to learning these skills. And in order to do that, meant they couldn't spend that time, energy, and resources on, for example, manual labor or crafts or things like that. So it suddenly becomes limited to a very specific part of society. Now, this is probably just right at the beginning. And there are actually lots of interesting studies about how the first writing would have actually been kind of used within society and by different people, because some research has suggested that actually, no, it would have been a lot more commonly used. And actually, maybe some of the first writing that we know of was invented by, you know, miners, by miners in far-flung places who were just trying to create some way of communication. So there's a lot of interesting studies on that. But the point being is that it's important to remember that once things get written down, the person who's writing it down has the power over the information that is being written. So the invention of writing and the start of writing is a huge step in the development of the society that we are in now, and the formation of things like hierarchies and classes and that kind of thing. So that's sort of writing, I guess. But what about notebooks? So I did a tour with World Virtual Tours, who I occasionally do online tours with, sort of webinars, basically. And I did one about notebooks, and I did a little word cloud poll to basically ask people to put down words that they associate with notebooks. So what do people think it is? And what was interesting is the biggest word that came up was paper, and other words included portable, memory, notes, etc. So I think that fits quite well, apart from the paper part. We're going to get back to that in a bit. But that fits quite well with the idea of a notebook. And actually, I want to do a quote from a paper by Richard Yeo from 2008, who said, "We use notebooks to record information that we do not want to forget, but not necessarily items that we wish to memorize. Our emphasis is on noting for later retrieval." And I really like this definition, because it also highlights the fact that it's not something that is necessarily supposed to be set in stone if it's a notebook. It's something that's just supposed to record temporary information that you might need at some point, but that doesn't have to be noted for forever. And something that I thought was quite important in regards to this, so it's about memory, it's about noting things down, it's about quick notes, it's about also having something that's portable. And I think that's something we also associate with notebooks, is that sort of being able to carry it around with you, being able to slip it in your pocket. If it's necessary for quick reference, you want to be able to have it, to be carrying it around. You don't want to have to, you know, go back and visit this carving in order to remember a note that you made, right? You want to be able to just have it on you and be able to refer to it whenever you want. So for me, a notebook is something which allows people to write down notes as a quick memory aid and is portable enough to be able to allow them to carry it around with them. On that note, let's take a very quick break to top off our tea, but we'll be right back to discuss then what the earliest notebooks were. Okay, welcome back, everyone. Hope you've got a nice full cup of tea now. So we had a very brief foray into the importance of writing and what a notebook could be sort of defined as. But let's have a little think about then, in light of those things, what is then the archaeology of notebooks? What would be the earliest form of a sort of portable device to store notes and memories on? And actually, one of the earliest types of notebook, if we consider this definition, you could argue, is not anything to do with paper, which was this word from the word cloud that I had come up with from the audience I had, but actually tablets made from clay. And these are the earliest forms of portable writing that we have, are these kinds of clay tablets. And they come from the area of Mesopotamia, which is kind of sort of Iraq, Syria area, and stretching all the way into kind of northeast Africa and all the way up into Turkey. It comes from the late Uruk period. So approximately 3,400 BCE is when the kind of oldest ones have been dated to. And the very early examples of these clay tablets aren't so much writing, they're more kind of pictograms. So they'll have different pictures representing the items that they're referring to. They have counting, which is in the form of little circles or dots that are on these tablets. But then you can see over time that these sort of pictograms develop into a particular kind of writing system known as cuneiform or cuneiform. And cuneiform actually lasted for thousands of years. I think the last archaeological example that we have of cuneiform tablets comes from 80 CE, so 80 after the year zero, the year 80. So that means that they were going for like nearly 3,500 years, which is quite incredible, really, that sort of form of not just the alphabet, because I mean, our alphabet's been around for that long. The Roman alphabet, in the case of me, because I use the Roman alphabet, has been around for that long. And other alphabets around the world have also been around for that long, but it's more the kind of medium that you use. The fact that they were using clay tablets for that long is quite incredible, I think. And cuneiform, I should highlight, is a writing. It's not a language. So it was used too much as the Latin alphabet is a writing, not a language, right? We use it to write different languages in. That's what cuneiform was as well. And what's really fascinating to me is when you look at the earliest forms of clay tablets, they're all used basically as administration notes. Like, so one of the earliest ones is about the payment that's due to a brewer, because beer was used as a form of payment back at this time for workers. So I find that really fascinating that the earliest notebooks that you have are not, you know, beautiful poems or thoughts or kind of philosophical meanderings. It's, oh, you know, Bob has to be paid 3 beers because he worked for 5 hours this week. I mean, you can tell, right, that one of the first sort of pictograms you have are these counting symbols. I mean, that kind of already gives a little bit of a clue that administration was quite a big part of this. And actually, you don't have the sort of earliest literary form that they found. It generally is believed to be the Epic of Gilgamesh. They are finding more things every day, though, so they might have found something else since I was here, since I record this. But the Epic of Gilgamesh, which refers to events from around 4,000 years ago, but actually the tablets themselves have been dated to the 7th century BCE, so, you know, 2,500, 3,000 years later. So there was a lot happening in between that point, and there probably were literary works, there probably were poems, there probably were songs written down. We just don't have the evidence for them. But what we have a lot of evidence for are basically payment notices, complaints, letters, those kinds of things, which I just find really interesting. But a lot of the earliest ones have been interpreted as sort of administrative notes, basically. And what's really important with clay tablets as well, of course, is that they only survive if they've been baked. So there might have been a lot more of them around that were kind of reused, you know. So you had the sort of the hard clay, but then you could just wet it and wipe the surface and sort of smooth it off again and reuse it. So also a kind of a useful thing for a notebook, right? To be able to reuse it and add extra notes and manipulate things a little bit. And the ones that we do have usually only survive because they were caught in a fire or something like that. And alongside clay tablets, you do actually also have wax tablets. We're not sure exactly how long they were being used for. The earliest example that we have comes from something called the Ulubrun shipwreck, which was found off the coast of Turkey, and it dates to the Bronze Age, to the 14th century BCE. And that's the sort of earliest actual physical example that we have. However, it was a really useful form because it was found in a shipwreck, right? It was waterproof. So it could be used in all kinds of different situations, whereas something like a clay tablet, as soon as it would get wet, it would be, you know, kind of useless for a while. You couldn't write in it in the rain or on a ship or things like that, whereas wax tablets could be. Wax tablets could also be really easily reused, right? You could just remold the wax and then that's fine. They used this sort of red or black wax at this time, which is quite interesting. And they used it all the way up until the medieval period. So they were using wax tablets for a long time. They were very useful objects. And it was a kind of similar method of writing to on clay tablets in terms of kind of inscribing the symbols rather than writing on the surface. You'd have to kind of make dents, you know, to into the top of the surface in order for the symbols to be seen. But then you start to get things like inks and thinner materials, for example, papyrus or parchment or paper. And these allow you to then create things like scrolls or codices, because they're a lot more kind of flexible and they're a lot thinner. So rather than having just like a tablet that you have to, you know, store somewhere, you have these really thin sheets of material that you can also then write on top of with an, with another material. So it's not kind of, you don't have to have it thick anymore. You can have it thin because you can write on top of it. And the earliest inks that would have been used would have been made from sort of carbon-based ink, so things like soot and everything. And then at some point in the medieval period, it's developed to the stage where they start to use something called iron gall inks, which, interestingly enough, I never realized they're made using a gall. And I didn't know that a gall was the like growths that you get on trees. So oak gall was a very commonly used ingredient in iron gall. And then they add sort of saline solutions and things to create the final ink. But anyway, a little interesting side ramble for you there. But and so these sort of scrolls and these codices especially are sort of starting to then become something that we maybe think a little bit more of when we think of things like notebooks. So if we go back, so probably the earliest material, at least the earliest material that we have archaeological evidence for is papyrus, which is probably one that you're all thinking of when we started this and we were talking about writing and earliest writing. And papyrus is created from the papyrus plant, which is Cyperus papyrus, Latin name, also known as paper reed or Nile grass. And basically it's made by kind of stripping down the plant into different layers. You have overlapping layers of these strips, which have been sort of worked. They're then pressed together in a nice big sort of heavy press. And then that sort of fuses them together in a way and they create these sheets. And you can probably imagine that if you picture a piece of papyrus in your head, you can see, if you look in detail at the background, you can see that kind of overlapping lattice almost of strips in the background. That's the papyrus, the paper reed, the Nile grass in the background. And the oldest archaeological example we have of papyrus is known as the Diary of Merer or Mirer, which comes from around 2500 BCE. It's been dated to this time for various reasons, but partly for with scientific dating techniques, but also because it refers to building materials and building activities happening under the pharaoh Khufu and within the region of the Giza pyramids. So this is actually quite exciting because it's a diary of basically an official, a technical official, who was in charge of stone deliveries, basically, they reckon, up and down the Nile towards the building of the Giza pyramids. So quite fascinating. Again, another admin sheet, but this is, it's called the Diary of Merer because it's sort of notes and thoughts and experiences of this administrative official, Merer, as he's going about his day. So it's, yeah, really exciting discovery, that one. So as well as papyrus, you also have parchment, which isn't created from plants. These ones are created from animal skins, usually goat or sheep or calf, depending on the region you're in. And it's a quite a long-winded process. You have to sort of dehair and deflesh the skins, generally by soaking them in some kind of lime solution. They're then scraped and they're stretched on a frame, scraped again, stretched again, scraped again, stretched again. And at some point it's sort of smoothed and sanded and it's become thin enough that you can have it as paper. But it's a very long process because you need to kind of constantly be reworking it. And there's this myth that parchment was invented by someone called Eumenes II in Pergamon. And that's where the name parchment comes from, is the city of Pergamon in the second century BCE. But actually, there's quite a lot of archaeological examples from much earlier than this. For example, amongst the Dead Sea Scrolls, you have some examples which are made from parchment and they've been dated to around 2000 BCE. So also quite early on. And then paper, in relation to papyrus and parchment, was actually quite a late invention. And I mean, I use the word invention here with caution because, of course, you know, invention implies that someone did it and made a patent and, you know, it was all good. But actually, what's really interesting is all these kinds of technologies, it just seemed to be a technology that whose time had come because it all sort of popped up in different places around the world. And even though you can see a little bit of interaction and sort of exchange of ideas and things in so many things in, well, prehistory and history, you can see actually that these technologies are sort of co-developing, which is fascinating. I mean, also that's going back into prehistory, right? When you think of things like metallurgy and language and agriculture and that kind of thing, they're sort of co-developing in different places around the world. So it just seems to be at some point an idea arrives and it's just sort of taken on, which is quite fascinating. So paper, as you might be aware, is created from plant fibers, sort of pulp. Earliest examples include hemp, mulberry bark, bamboo, and flax, amongst other things. And the pulp can either be made from the raw plant, or quite often it was used from rags made from the plant. That was happening until quite a long time. And then I don't know how many people have sort of made paper themselves, but you have the pulp, you kind of put them in a bath basically, and then you have a frame that you put underneath the pulp in the bath and sort of put it up so that the pulp lies flat on this frame that then dries it to create these sheets, which can then be written on a paper sheet. So there's another myth around this one as well, or a kind of legend, that it was invented in 105 CE, so the year 105, attributed to someone called Chai Lun, who was a court official in the Han Dynasty, and he sort of wrote down that this was happening. But actually, again, there's archaeological evidence from a little bit earlier, from 200 BC, so from around 300 years earlier, from the city of Bakchao, where they found some hemp paper, or something that they've interpreted as hemp paper. There's also some historic sources, interestingly enough, from Alexander the Great, that suggest that they were actually maybe using cotton to make paper in India from as early as kind of 300 BCE, but we don't have archaeological evidence for it. But that would be something to, you know, keep in mind as well, is that it's all of these materials are all organic, right? So that means that they don't preserve well in the archaeological record. They break down a lot quicker and they disintegrate in the ground. So you have to have really specific sort of preservation conditions in order for them to actually survive to the modern day for archaeologists to dig them up, you know? So who knows? Maybe there was paper earlier. We just haven't found evidence of it. So we've already discussed a little bit about sort of scrolls and the codex, which is sort of, I guess, the precursor or maybe even the earliest examples of what we would consider to be books, because they have the classic multiple sheets bound together, usually some sort of cover, which is supposed to protect the sheets. And these date back to sort of the 2nd century BC in the Mediterranean area. You also have, for example, in India, a lot of alternative kinds of bookbinding, which almost are more like a blind. So they're made from these long, thin sheets of things like bamboo, and they have holes more in the center. And you then, you know, the blinds that you kind of pull up and pull down, and they have overlapping flaps. They're more that kind of binding than what we would consider as a sort of book binding in that case. And those are dated to a little bit later, the kind of 8th and 9th century is the earliest examples we have of those. But as the years go on, binding gets gradually more and more complex. However, notebooks still aren't that common because, as we've just gone through, creating all of these materials is quite time intensive. And so therefore, it's quite expensive still. Only the sort of upper classes are able to read them. The actual process of creating the books is also quite time consuming. Even if you're not handwriting things in terms of books, at this point, it's sort of blocks, wood blocks and things to create written books and printed books. And actually, the sort of really when things start to take off is in the mid-1400s, where someone called Johann Gutenberg created something known as the Gutenberg Press, which no doubt you have heard of because it's very famous. And it basically allowed a little bit more sort of mass production of printed material. And while notebooks, of course, the whole point of them is that they're empty. They're not printed, right? They're not filled. We fill them. But when this took off, when the starting of sort of printed books took off, that meant that the whole process of making books also became a lot more intentional for the mass-produced market. So the materials became cheaper. The way of binding the books became cheaper, more affordable, quicker in that respect. So in that respect, not only books took off and became sort of cheaper and more accessible to everyone, but also notebooks, books with nothing in them, also became a little bit more accessible and available. And in the Renaissance is when they really took off because, I mean, you had, for example, great minds such as Leonardo da Vinci, who famously, you know, wrote in his notebooks, did his mirror writing, did all his nice diagrams and everything. But you also had something known as the commonplace book, which was basically used by everyone. Anyone who could write would use this. And it was sort of almost the first form of the daily journal in a way. And then, yeah, that just carried on. And then nowadays you have an extremely wide range of books. And what I find really interesting actually is nowadays, I mean, if you write in an actual notebook, you know, you're probably in the minority now in a lot of ways because technology means that now it's actually more normal for people to type on their phone or to, you know, type on their laptop and things. And I mean, even laptops, right, are quite often called notebooks. When I was looking up about this and I was trying to find information about notebooks, a lot of the time at the beginning, it was coming up with all these things for laptops rather than for sort of traditional notebooks as we've talked about them today. And I, like I sort of mentioned earlier, I think it's really fascinating that the notebook as a technology now then is just so part of everyday life and it's so normal, but it's also so kind of traditional and old fashioned, but then everyone could use a notebook. You'll always find notebooks everywhere. And it, when it first started, it would have been such a, the, you know, that idea of the start of writing that we had at the beginning, you know, and this idea that writing as a thing would make such a difference to society. And now we're talking about similar things in terms of AI and other forms of writing. So it just makes you think about how does the use of a notebook, a kind of traditional notebook, compare to us using things like computers, compare to us using tools like AI? What actually is the difference? Because there have been massive changes in that. By the way, I am in no way, you know, saying everyone should use AI or everyone should use computers. Like I said, I am very much for using handwritten notebooks. I love them. It's just an interesting thought to follow through on when you think about actually the grand scheme of human history and all these different technologies that we now just take for granted or even see as old-fashioned. But at the time, they would have been considered, you know, something potentially dangerous as well, which I find quite interesting. Anyway, very brief. I hope that you enjoyed this little shallow foray into the origins of the simple notebook. We're going to be continuing in the same theme for the next couple of episodes. So I'm going to be chatting with a professional bookbinder, Alexander Sabir, all about the craft of notebook making. And I'll also be talking with medieval manuscript expert, Professor Lisa Fagan-Davies, all about that most mysterious of notebooks, the Voynich manuscript. So look out for those ones coming up. Also, you can check the show notes, as always, for any contact information and also any links that have provide further reading to the points that I mentioned today. Until then, happy drinking and see you next time. Thank you for joining me on this tea break. If you like this episode, please do like, follow or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Don't forget to check out the other shows on the APN for more fun archaeology content. And if you'd like to learn more about the topic of today's episode, make sure to check the show notes for links and further information.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.